Welcome to episode 393 of the Thunder Underground podcast. Trent here as always. And this is generally where I say something like, we've got a great episode this week. So I think that means I have to say we've got an exceptional episode this week. Corey Glover and Vernon Reed of Living Color are here on this podcast. That's something I always hoped I could say. You know, I've repeated this many times with other artists. I said this when I first mentioned that I did this interview a couple weeks ago. From the beginning, when Jason and I started this podcast nearly 9 years ago, you know, we had a list of people that we had, you know, lofty goals of one day getting on this podcast. And any of the four members of Living Color was definitely high on that list. So to be able to finally do this is extremely cool. And I'm so happy to be able to bring you this interview that we're going to jump into here very soon. But first, I need to let you know who sponsors this podcast. DEB Concerts, a promoter based right here in Tulsa, Oklahoma, has brought many great acts to the Oklahoma area, and they never stop. Coming up next month, April 24th, at the Shrine, Venue Shrine in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Faster Pussycat will be returning. And our good friends in Dime Store Riot will be opening that show. So hit up the Venue Shrine and hit up debconcerts.com to find out ticket info. Also follow DEB on all their socials so you don't miss any other updates, which is DEB Concerts on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. DEB Concerts also books the Roadhouse stage every year at Rocklahoma. This year will be no different. And that announcement should be here by the next time I talk to you next week. Rocklahoma just announced that they are dropping the lineup sometime next week. So looking forward to see what DEB has in store for us in the Roadhouse stage. We'll, of course, be talking in length about that throughout the months ahead. And we usually have Doug on, usually to talk about it as well before Rocklahoma hits later this year. But until then, follow DEB and let them know you heard about them right here. We've also got Sunset Tattoo, a tattoo shop located in Midtown Tulsa. They are native owned and they have well over 25 years of experience. Jake and his crew over there do amazing work. There's a female artist on staff. If you call or message, you can set up an appointment to go in there and talk about what work you're looking to have done. You can also walk in. You can also hit him up on all the socials. They are on Facebook and Instagram at Sunset Tattoo Tulsa. Tons of photos on there, so you can check out all their previous work. I've personally had work done by Jake more than once. I just recently got a new tattoo from him. I'm very pleased, and I know you will be as well if you get in there and get work done from Sunset Tattoo. So hit him up and tell him you heard about him right here on Thunder Underground. All right, the subject at hand. Living Color. Like I mentioned up front, this is a huge honor to me, being a lifelong fan of this band. You know, like I've mentioned many times throughout the history of this podcast, you know, I really started getting into music more heavily in the mid to late 80s, you know, as I started, got around age 10 to 11. And that was exactly the time that Living Color came out. Literally, 1988, I was 11 years old. So with everything, you know, the first thing that I really got into was Warrant and Poison and Def Leppard and Bon Jovi and Guns N' Roses and all of that. And then within a couple years, I became a massive fan of bands like Faith No More and Living Color, along with stuff a lot heavier like Megadeth or Anthrax and Pantera, etc. But Living Color stood out amongst all those bands. They were just playing hard rock mixed with elements of, you know, funk and just all kinds of greatness rolled into this package that didn't technically fit what was on the radio in the sense of, you know, it was all hard rock, but as far as glam metal or whatever, which then you know, shifted into eventually into grunge or whatever. But Living Color, you know, had a massive hit with Cult of Personality because that song fit perfectly amidst, you know, in the middle of all those styles of rock. But it also fit thematically, you know, with culture around the world, as it still does to this day. And that's something that, you know, we talk about pretty early on in this interview, is that anyone that's followed Living Color knows that lyrically this band has always been wildly relevant. You know, you can say, oh, this, you know, this song here or there by so-and-so, you know, like say Buffalo Springfield, for what it's worth, you know, is relevant now just like it was 50 years ago. With Living Color, you could literally say that about pretty much any song they've ever written, you know, in my opinion. You know, and we talk about that heavily with the album Stain, but everything that came before or after that, Living Color, you know, has always been known as quote-unquote like a political band or a band that brings real life, real elements of life, culture, everything that's going on around the world, you know, whether it be good or whether it be bad, which usually it's something negative if you've got to discuss it openly, right? So Living Color has always embraced that, whether, you know, it come to politics, war, sexuality, race, obviously, all that stuff. Living Color are the masters at it. And they are just like, they've always been one of those bands to me, like, you could take every album of theirs and put it into a single playlist and then hit play, hit shuffle, and never need to skip a song. You know, the slogan or whatever you call it, the, you know, me and Jason went with at the beginning of this podcast was hashtag all killer, no filler. And this band is the epitome of that. They always have been. And on top of all that, just being a great band that's writes great music that is always relevant, their musicianship is next level. You know, I say that the two men that are on this podcast with me are two of rock and roll's greats, all-time greats. And the two men that are in the band that weren't on this podcast are two of the all-time greats as well. Corey Glover, Vernon Reid, Doug Wimbush, Will Calhoun. There's very few bands in the history of music that I think you can say that every single member standing alone is at the top of his game, you know, is at the top of a list of great artists on his instrument. The Who, Led Zeppelin, Deep Purple, a couple of the Whitesnake lineups. Is that where it ends? I'm sure I'm not thinking, you know, there's something I'm forgetting. But, you know, those are bands that you can take every single member and say, this is an all-time great. You know, because there's other bands where there's a couple all-time greats, and then you've got just a couple other guys that are good. You know, but that's going off on a tangent. But the point is, these guys are in rare air when it comes to, you know, how great they singularly are. And when you put together how great they are as the entity that is Living Color. I can ramble on and on. That's what I tend to do, especially when it's someone I'm a fan of, you know, trying not to fanboy out here. But it's obviously going to happen here in the intro. Every year, as most any media entity, whether it be written or spoken or video, you know, puts out their best of the year, whether it be albums or songs or whatever, here at Thunder Underground, it's always been the year-end best of albums of that year when it comes to hard rock and metal. You know, Jason and I started doing this. We actually did it in print before the podcast came out, but the first year of the podcast was 2015. And then in, I guess it was the next year, right? 2016 was when Shade came out. The last, actually was it 2017? It is, you know, currently Living Color's most recent studio album. We had it at number 3 that year as the third best album of the year. I'm telling you that to tell you that this band has never stopped releasing great stuff, like I just told a little while ago. All killer, no filler. Shade is an exceptional album. like I said before, whether lyrics were written in 1989 or 88, or whether they were written in 2017 or today, they're going to stand the test of time. So check out Shade if you have not. Okay, so a couple things when it comes to this interview. Corey Glover. He has a new band, a side project called Sonic Universe that he's doing with Mike Orlando. Mike Orlando, of course, the guitarist of Adrenaline Mob. Mike Orlando is one of those talents that has always kind of been overlooked, I think, by a lot of people. So I'm glad that he's got a new project with another exceptional singer. You know, he had Russell Allen with him in Adrenaline Mob. Which, side note, shameless plug, Russell Allen from Adrenaline Mob and Symphony X has been on this podcast before. So check that one out if you have not. But Mike Orlando, Corey Glover, quote-unquote kicking out the jams here with Sonic Universe. They've got their first single out, came out a few weeks ago, called I Am. We're going to talk about that here in just a bit with Corey Glover. Absolutely looking forward to this. Based off that one song, this thing's going to be killer. You know it's going to be killer. Corey Glover has done a lot of guest spots throughout the years, and they always sound killer. Corey Glover has released solo music that is killer. Corey Glover is actually, you know, if we want to talk about relevant to this podcast, a few years ago now, on episode 234, Stevie D was on here to talk about his album, which featured Corey Glover on lead vocals. Stevie D featuring Corey Glover was a solo album that he had Corey on as a guest, and that was an absolute killer album as well, if you have not. So check that one out. That came out, I believe, in 2019. So that's something cool to hear if you have not. So on March 4th, Living Color, earlier this month, played at the Beer City Music Hall in Oklahoma City. Fantastic show from this amazing band, and I had the opportunity to head down there and got to do this interview earlier in the day before the show. And I wanted to mention a couple things that, you know, for the longest period of time when Jason and I were doing this, tons of our episodes were always done on site, you know, whether it be pre-show or post-show from a touring artist, or, you know, whether it be a local or regional artist, you know, go to a place and meet them, whatever. There was a lot less Zoom interviews, you know, and once the pandemic hit, we started doing a lot of Zoom stuff. And then since Jason left the podcast, I've kind of done more so on Zoom than I have in person, because my work, you know, working in the live music industry has kind of taken me away from being home a lot. So it's way easier to get these interviews done in Zoom. But I say all that to say, this obviously was done in person before the show. And it was cool to, you know, to kind of get back to doing that, because I haven't done one in person since, I couldn't even think when the last one was. I mean, I think it was probably, at least with someone on tour, probably almost a year. And then before, you know, besides that, even someone regional or local, that was probably last summer. So it's kind of, you know, feels good to jump back into that vein of things. And then I say that, and then all the following interviews that are coming up, the next five episodes were all recorded on Zoom. So anyway, this was recorded on Living Color's tour bus, and I mention that because, you know, I have to mess with the audio, especially whenever you're on site like that, and there's always going to be a decent amount of background noise. And being on a tour bus, you know, you've got the bus running, air, all that stuff. And coupled with the fact that, in full transparency, you know, this was scheduled as a Corey Glover interview, so that's just kind of what I was prepared to do when I sat down in the bus, and then Vernon Reed was there and just joined in on the interview. So he was sitting a little bit further away, and I didn't really resituate myself or him to manage that, because I didn't realize, like I said, that he was going to be a full part of the interview. And once it got going, I kind of just got lost in the moment and forgot that, oh yeah, he's a little too far from this microphone. But I think I got enough of the audio levels raised up. This should be perfectly fine, but I just wanted to let you know why it seems like at times my voice and Corey Glover's voice is a bit louder than Vernon's voice. But I'm super, super stoked that Vernon was a part of this. We all know that this guy, extremely smart, extremely well-versed, you know, a social advocate for all kinds of things. Just a great person. If you don't follow him on social media, you should do so. You just always gain knowledge from him. And then on top of that, you get great fucking rock and roll from him as well. So with all that being said, let's jump into this interview here with Corey Glover and Vernon Reid of Living Color.
We're not done yet. Next week we finish up.
I remember when that was announced, it seemed like it kind of took me off guard as an odd pairing, but when you really think about it, it works well. Like, I assume the crowd's great.
The crowd's been great. There's a similarity, I think, between us and them. And, you know, we came out around the same time. So, and it's been, you know, we get along like gangbusters, so it's not bad.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because I feel like you guys were always kind of underappreciated on your slower songs, and they were always underappreciated on their heavier songs.
Right. Right.
Have you guys ever performed with them before, or is this kind of a new deal?
This is the first time we've actually played
outside of festivals, bro.
We've known each other for a while, but we haven't.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you just celebrated literally like, what, 2 or 3 days ago, the 31st anniversary of Staying.
Yep.
You guys have been out on the road performing that basically in its entirety?
Not in its entirety.
We're close to it. We've done a few things like that. Now we mix it up.
Yeah. Okay.
But Staying is kind of the basis. I mean, when we do the longer shows, so we throw in some Staying things when we play with Extreme.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Were there any songs that are being played this past year for the first time ever, or had everything been done throughout history?
Play a few things that we haven't played in a long time. When we do the Staying-ish show, last year we did Staying in its entirety, and now we've done a kind of still in the proximity of it, but we've thrown in some other things. Like we played Flying for the first time in a really long time. You know, in the show last week, we played Funny Vibe last night. You know, we don't play nothingness all the time. You know, we don't play Mind Your Own Business all the time. We don't play By all the time. You know, and it's been really fun. Because some of the songs are very, they're still confrontational.
Yeah.
You know, like Postman is a very, it's a very confrontational thing because, you know, we're living in such an epidemic of mass shootings and things, you know. And back then, it was anecdotally, it was called going postal, right? The idea that somebody with a bland job, just a guy that everybody thinks is nice, you know, they see him every day, and one day he comes and starts bucking on shots. So a lot of stuff that, from Staying, it's a record that's still, by and talking about sexuality openly, you know, so it's confronting, but not in a super aggro way. But it's you think about these things, you know, they can be challenging. You know? Just to let it sit, to let it be what it is, and not explain it, right? Mm-hmm. Because doing Postman. Because it kind of goes without saying that we don't approve of what he does. It goes without saying that we're horrified. But the idea of stepping into that person's shoes and not judging them and say what it is from their point of view, that's something that we took on. And And I'm really proud that we did take it on. It still doesn't make it less difficult,
right,
to look at that.
Right.
Well, like those songs, or even a song like Wall, I mean, the lyrics, all that stuff was written over 30 years ago. And I mean, and it's kind of sad to think about, but also shows how relevant your guys' music has always been.
It's weirdly even more, because it's so much more divided. The country's always had its divisions, but those divisions have been sharpened and emphasized by social media technology. So a lot of one of the weird things about us is that a lot of our conversation from the first album all the way through, and particularly those records from that first set, those things are not relevant in the background. They're, you know, everything from Cole to Postman to all those things. They are
the Time's Up.
The Time's Up. Like, Time's Up is more relevant now. It's, you know, we're in Oklahoma City. It's barely March. It's 71 degrees outside. Right. It's warmer here than it is in California. Right, right now, there's these fires in Texas. They're burning millions of acres away. When the summer comes and the numbers and the stats come out, it's going to be the hottest summer on record. It's going to be hotter than it was last summer, and last summer was the hottest summer on record.
Right.
Like, and when Corey wrote those lyrics, we really wanted to do like a tribute to the Bad Brains, you know? Because that's kind of where we kind of came from, out of the CBGB's kind of milieu, right? And Corey had these lyrics, and I was like, man, I remember thinking, man, this is so unique, it's so really unusual. So let's go with it, right? So we did it. And then it turned out, you know, that of that record, that's one of the most pointed now, you know, along with a song like This Is the Life. And then taking on something like Flying, and nobody sang about it. Very few people sang about the day, you know? And you know, there's a certain amount of just facing daily absurdity. So here we are.
Well, when you think about the music from Stain, like, the climate at that time was perfect, I think, for a song like Postman because of the changing music scene. But do you think you guys having success in the previous era kind of affected that not getting as much love as it should have at the time, probably?
Well,
or is that kind of an overstatement?
It's tough to say. You know, you get very few bites at the apple. And to say that we didn't get that is patently false, of course. That being said, I think with the advent of what we've been doing lately, I think people's understanding and their eye on Living Color and seeing, oh yeah, they did talk about this stuff 30 years ago, that, you know, that Time's Up is more prescient now than it was then, I think is a conversation that's going to become a conversation about the band and about what we've done and what we've accomplished. But to say that, you know, that those songs didn't get the love that they deserve, that's a matter of perspective, because we keep plugging at it, we keep playing it, you know, and we still get the same sort of reaction from it. So it's hard to say.
Yeah, it's weird because the conversation kind of was like, well, you're a political band. We have a lot of songs that are kind of personal songs that, you know, get sort of really overlooked, because we just talked about life as it occurred to us. You know, life, in a way, I mean, we made certain choices. So we took on, because we're also children of the Adam.
Right.
You know, and that also defined us as well. And we were, you know, before the Wall came down, you know, it was still a Checkpoint Charlie, all like that. So in a way, Cult of Personality is very much about the kind of great man power dynamics that were at play, you know, for forever, right? Up, up in, particularly in the 60s and 50s, you know, these personages were rise, a Gandhi, a Mussolini, you know, in the 40s, you know, Truman, Medgar Evers, you know, these people were larger than life and paid with their lives for being larger than life. That's part of the thing about JFK. Because it was as much, I mean, the fact that he was the youngest president is one thing. The fact that he was Catholic, an Irish Catholic, that was like a, you know, that was like a whole thing. Because most of the presidents were Protestant. Right? So it's beyond where they're, you know, the white male thing. It's almost was like, almost what without saying for the longest time. I remember seeing, I was little, I remember the Nixon Kennedy debate. Nixon was unshaven, you know, and Kennedy was a movie star. I mean, just, I knew nothing about politics. Nothing about it, but that guy, that looks like a movie star, he's going to be president. And these things, I mean, they're serious. We can't separate the fact that Martin Luther King and Malcolm X were matinee idols. I mean, their message was serious at the same time. You know, her message is serious. Angela Davis. Angela Davis is a fashion icon. And that's a part and parcel of what made them larger than life. And we're living beyond Andy Warhol's idea of, you know, everyone will be famous for 15 minutes. I mean, people are famous that you don't know anything about. You have no idea. We used to know kind of all the famous people. Now, there are people on YouTube who have a million followers, a million people. And I'm saying there's a multiplicity of people.
There's kids on there with that.
Who are followed by a million people and you don't know anything about them. So, the idea of someone having that kind of influence but being completely below the public radar,
right,
is unprecedented. Yeah.
Changing the subject a little bit, in the recent live shows, you guys have been playing Kick Out the Jams.
Oh, yeah.
Assumedly in a tribute to the recent loss of Wayne Kramer.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did MC5 have an effect on both of you, like at a young age, or is it something you gravitated towards as you got older?
When you study the whole history of punk music, and, you know, punk music begot hardcore became metal, and metal became, you know, and there's metalcore, and all the kinds of stuff that it came out of. And then you hear the burgeoning ideas of it, of like the MC5 and the Stooges and the Ramones and everything else. You see the connective tissue of it all. So, us playing it is sort of not just paying an homage to Wayne Kramer and MC5, but that whole genre that sort of, to a large degree, birthed us. Like, we came out of that hardcore scene in downtown New York, and they got their information from Wayne and them. So, it's sort of like a continuum. It's a constant continuum. And we play the song really well, so.
It's kind of funny, because it's like thinking about the Midwest and Detroit in particular, because there's so much of the conversation in the culture wars about the coastal elites, you know, about the prominence of New York, the prominence of L.A. It's really important to recognize the fact that the Midwest has had a massive influence, you know, in thinking about MC Bob, but also Death from Detroit. Right? It's like they were one of the early black rock bands. You know, and to think that to pick out these pieces and, you know, kick out the jams is just incredibly confrontational. The other thing about Wayne Kramer is that Wayne, who I've gotten a chance to get to know, you know, really kind of via Tom Morello. And, you know, Wayne was a prisoner's rights, an inmate's rights activist. You know, he'd been in jail for something related to narcotics, and he'd become a real student of the criminal mind and also alleviating conditions, you know, for inmates across the country. So he's a very important, great guitar player, but a heroic figure in the music. Absolutely. So it's an honor to play that particular game.
Side note, I never got the chance to see MC5, but I went to a Tom Morello solo show 17, 18 years ago when he brought out Wayne Kramer and Nuno Betancourt.
Oh, yeah.
Les Claypool and Slash and Perry Farrell, and they played Kick Out the Jams. So
yeah.
He's pretty unique experience.
Yeah. Tom has been a pivotal person. He's a connecting dots between the past and the present.
I mean, do you think if a band like MC5 that is that important to the history of rock and roll, it's like insane that they're still not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Well, it's just now they got nominated again, but who knows if they get in. But
I don't think at the time, in their time, I don't think they wanted those kind of accolades, but right. They deserve them.
Well, yeah.
What's the thing? I'd never join a club that would have me as a member.
Yeah. That was Groucho Marx.
Groucho Marx. So, but we've had our, recently we've had our issues with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and their ideas of what they deem as worthy of.
Oh, Jan Wenner. Yeah.
Not even Jan, but, I wrote this thing about, what's his name? Landau. Because Lenny Kravitz was talking about in certain places he's never been to a BET Awards or anything like that. None of us have really been a part of that. But, what does that mean that these organizations will give you an award for being that? What does that do? What does that do? It just acknowledges that you are working. The best way to acknowledge that is to keep working, to me.
Yeah. I mean, acknowledgement is important. And there are people, there's so many people who go unacknowledged. They go unacknowledged because they passed on too early, or they left the business, or they, the influential people are not just the people who are those that sold the most records.
Right.
The maintenance of the hierarchical nature of what certain people have taken that on to say and define who's in and who's out. And that's about power. That's about who has the power to determine. Who has the power to declare a king or a prince or whatever? Who says who matters? And that has been there's been tension around that for a really long time. If you look closely at even at Jimi Hendrix. And there's some the coverage of Jimi Hendrix, we can go through the history of it. He was discounted. A lot of deeply racist stuff. Even as their minds were blown, there was a lot of who does this so and so think he is? And that was a problem. That was for many, and that was a problem because, if he hadn't have gone to England, I sincerely doubt that he would have become the Jimi Hendrix that everybody knows. People were content to, he's nice, and blah, blah, blah. But to take him seriously and say, hey, man, you should go to England. Chas Chandler heard him, and man, you are special, let's do this thing. And the fact that Jimmy said, yeah, I'll go. And everything swung around that. But his legacy is, it seems, you look at it one way, and you see how he's accepted and revered as a hero and respected as such. But if you look closely at what happened directly like one of my pet peeves is the treatment of Ernie Isley of the Isley Brothers. How Ernie Isley, the guitarist, never got his the respect he deserved. You know, when he was young and really had been incredibly successful and brought success to, you know, helped kind of reignite the career of the Isley Brothers. But it's all, but it goes hand in hand with how the Isley Brothers are kind of boxed into, oh, they're a great R&B band, but actually they're a rock and roll band who's incredibly influential. They're the longest, and they're still active, they're only two left. Ernie and Ron. And their influence, when the Beatles play Shea Stadium, they started with Shout. Twist and Shout, they started with, you know, an Isley Brothers tour. And so, and this is the part and parcel of who determines what it is, who grades the importance, and who can present that as a kind of accepted reality that everybody, we're all supposed to acknowledge and accept.
Right.
And even and beyond whether or not the individual is responsible for the accolades they receive or don't receive. It's remarkable. It's kind of, it's not like, you know, drugs suddenly, you know, being seen as a kind of disease, as a disease, addiction, as opposed to an inherent depraved moral failing, as it was applied to jazz musicians. You know? It was never seen that basically these were geniuses growing up in a segregated racist America, and they were self-medicating their anxiety and depression. That language was going to come to decades later. And it's still not applied to them. It's still not applied to Charlie Parker.
Hello.
Hello.
Very not so nice a place. Hi, Olaya.
Hi, Trent.
Nice to meet you.
Good to meet you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the acknowledgement. I feel like it's important for someone, especially like MC5, just because there's so many people that were born in the last 30 years that probably don't even know who the hell it is.
Don't know who they are.
Just like one note, like, hey, these five artists made it into the Rock and Roll of Fame, here's one of them, you would hope it would open the minds of a few people to check out. You know?
Well, it's kind of, well, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is kind of a black box.
Yes.
You know, it's like, it's not like whoever grants the McCarthy's. People that say, they're cool.
Well, hopefully that changes now that, you know, that one individual's gone. Like, I just spoke to, I remember a foreigner recently, and he said, you know, the first year that individual's gone is the first year we're nominated, so, you know, maybe that means something, who knows.
It's amazing, yeah. Right? People talking about foreigner, I mean, just from the standpoint of their importance in their era, you know, the success they had, it's like, it's, but there's a thing about worth in the marketplace and taste. Like who's in power? Whose tastes are in power?
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's part and parcel of the whole thing. You know, Kiss was not, you know, I mean, it's denied entry for years. Whatever, however you feel about Kiss, I mean, it's obvious. But there are a lot of obvious people that are being obvious to me.
Mentioned Stain earlier, something else that, you know, celebrated 30 years last year was the Judgment Night soundtrack. Which was also very important, I believe, and, you know, still one of the coolest soundtracks ever. Like, was the writing process for Me, Myself, and Microphone done separately, or did the, you guys and NMC work together more?
Yeah, we put together the music, and we really, you know, we kind of delivered things back and forth, but we worked really directly with Jam Master Jam.
Okay.
You know, and so His Murder was a particular blow. And now that you know, there's been a conviction. You know, that's a very, because for so long, you know, these murders would go, just, they would be unsolved, they would go cold, because no one would talk to cops, no one would talk to the police. You know, and I understand the distrust of the police. It was interesting that a detective was assigned to that case, who's hip hop fan. He's like, you know, I mean, Song Queens, and then he made it a particular mission, you know, because he's part of the community. And he loved the music to you know, bring these suspects to trial. Eventually, it happened. Yeah, man. It was working with them. You know, me, myself, and Michael was great. I love how it turned out. And I'm really proud of how it sits with the rest. You know, because it's an incredible record of all these different collaborations. So.
So when you worked with Jam Master Jay, was that in studio and everything, or was it done?
Right?
No, it was at Electric Lady.
Electric Lady, that's right. That's right.
Wow. And then I'm assuming Ron and DMC, like, added their vocals after the fact, or, I mean, like, separate from the session.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So we actually, like, again, we kind of made tracks and sound but we worked directly with Jam.
Well, back to you guys. I mean, or your music. It's been, what, 7-8 years now since Shade. Is there any talk or works on anything?
We started work on Next Day.
Okay. Is it like a slow working process thing, or do you guys have a timetable planned out?
We don't have a timetable, but we are committed to making another record. And trying to finish it sometime this year.
Yeah.
I think.
I mean, part of it is, you know, we're in a place of shaping what we're talking about. There's a particular conversation. Like, Shade is a particular conversation. And we have some thoughts about the conversation we're going to have.
Right.
And so far, and then there's the music. There's the conceptual framework, and then there's the actual music that emerges that can go along with it or go against it. Or what tunes have that thing that moves us and feels like it's part of it? It's like, you know, Shade, we went, I mean, it was at one point, you know, so are we going to, you know, do a lot of little hurdles that we had to get through. In the end, this whole idea of trying to relate blues and metal and hard rock together, we actually did it, but we had to kind of go through the blues in order to do it. And I think where we are right now, the uncertainty, and also the uncertainty of the current time, where is all this going to go? That there's nobody that can tell you, not a person. And that's a part of the feeling. That's a part of it. Not the whole thing, but a definite feeling.
Well, I always like to ask artists that have been around a long time, like, if their thought process, you know, changed. Because, I mean, obviously you're writing stuff in your 20s and now you're in your 60s. So, like, obviously, with you guys, it's different because we just talked about, like, your stuff from back then still holds relevance now. And you're writing about things going currently, but does the process of the way you think now at your age differ much from what it did 40 years ago or when you first started writing music?
There's an immediacy now, I think, that wasn't there particularly before. It's like, we'll get to it. Yeah, we'll get to it. But there is a, you know, not that we're chasing something, but something needs to be said, and it's very hard in some cases for people to, when you finally get a place to platform your ideas, there's such an onus on you to sort of, so much you want to say, so much
so much of the world that you observe that no one is talking about. And we have, and we're charged with an awesome responsibility to be able to say it succinctly. And I think that's where we come up, that's where we hit, sort of like hit a wall. It's like, is this saying exactly what we want to say and how we want to say it? Are we skirting around the issue or are we being direct about it? That has to be talked to. That has to be spoken to. Whatever it is that we need, that we think needs to be spoken to, has to be said directly. And how do you make that into a song that everybody would tap their toes to? There's a lot of calculus involved.
It's also about being nuanced at the same time. It's being direct and nuanced. Because you can say something, or you can say something that refers to the thing that you're actually saying.
Right.
You know, how do we get, and that's how we did, because we don't really like to be like totally. Some of the things were very narrative, like say the local ledger landlord. But a song like Type is really conceptual. So both things are present inside of what Living Color is. It's very direct, and there's also like, you know, like heavy things and heavy bad, heavy thoughts on my mind. Referring to things, not necessarily saying them directly. Like, say, I got a gun.
Right.
You know, and like, you know, and even, and sometimes that can just feel like, a tear that takes forever rolls down your top of his face. So there's things in ways of doing it. In the language, you know, nothing lasts forever. That's as much a part of what the band is as saying, you know, last night there was a fire. I heard seven children die. You know, like there's as much, you know, like I don't have to be the best. I don't want to be just like the rest. You know, that's not We Are the Champions, my friend.
Yeah.
You know, that's a different tact.
Right.
And again, you know, throughout all the records, both things are present. Both right at you and coming ladder. And I'm now at this time, with all the things we've been and also lost, right? You're talking about Wayne Kramer, there's so many sacred symbols, there's so many people. You know, Ronnie Drake, you know, so many people are part of our extended family. Greg Tate. There's so many people who are, you know, we want to make something that they would want to hear.
Right.
That they would be. You know, I want to do something that Edwin Bird songs. Oh man, that's dope. You know? That is also part of it. So, and that's what we're engaged in looking, finding, creating.
When it comes to the actual writing and creating process, has that changed for you guys throughout the years? Or do you still do that the same way you used to, or now with technology, is it like, you know, you send over some music via Zoom or something, or I mean, however, you know, because there's so much more technology now than there was.
I know. I have. We're doing a bunch of different things. You know, part of it, sometimes we'll just get together and start free associating. You know, Corey and I have done co-writing in the past, and we're going to keep that. You know, they're different individual writers and co-writers. But the, again, talking about what the conversation is, we're no longer 20, right? Like, at the same time, it can't be one of these, when it becomes too self-referential about how hard it is to be in a rock and roll band. But there's a place to even, you know, if we found a way in a song to not do that, but it moved us and worked, then that would happen.
Well, speaking on music that is done, Sonic Universe just released I Am
yes.
a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about, like, how that whole process came together. I know it was kind of announced a few years ago. Was it recorded? Setting or schedules not working out?
Yeah, it was a matter of when we could be available for it.
Right.
And, you know, and it required, you know, in the same way that I'd go get together with Vernon, I'd go to Staten Island and go to Mike Orlando's place and we sit down and work on things there. And, you know, that first single, I Am, basically came out of that sort of process. That was like the very first song we sort of wrote together. And, you know, the difference between the Living Color process and the process with Sonic Universe is this is sort of like me looking in as opposed to me looking out.
Okay.
And, you know, I Am is a declarative statement. As a song, it's a declarative statement that, you know, to a certain degree, you kind of overlooked people like me and Mike Orlando, but we're here. And we'll always be here. You know? And so that was our sort of statement going forward. And a lot of the songs are about that kind of thing. You know, we're here. You know, we're here also.
So thematically, it's a good indication, like musically, is it a good indication of what to expect from the rest of the album?
Yes. Okay. Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, we tried really hard to not allude to our past, because our past sort of informed where we're at, particularly at that particular point in time. And we just, you know, it's hanging over our shoulder, but we didn't deal with it head on. It was like, we're going to deal with how we're going about it, you know. And for Mike, it was a different kind of take on that idea. And he's a really good songwriter and a really good producer, so it was fun.
Was it easy for you to write lyrically that way? Like you said, inward instead of outward, like you used to? Or?
No.
It was like a struggle at first. Or?
It is a struggle. I think all of it. I think that, and this goes back to the thing about us getting together to write. The struggle is saying what you have in your head succinctly and saying it in a way that makes sense. It's hard. It's very hard. I got tons of ideas. I got tons of things and plenty of observations on the world and my place in it. But it's hard to pinpoint that one thing, that overall sort of overarching idea.
Is this something you guys think you're going to play live shows with, or is it like a studio?
No, we're going to play live. We're going to try to, you know, I've carved out some time in June, so hopefully we'll get together and do some stuff then.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm actually really excited that, you know, even though, you know, their pockets of time to do it. It's, I kind of think, you know, given some of the conversations that Corey and I have had, and what is actually happening there,
right,
is so, because there's a wonderful place of uncertainty, but everybody's in the same boat. And that's a great, weirdly enough, that's a great place to work. It's exciting in a way that's also not, it's not, when I say it's an exciting time, that doesn't mean that it's, well, it's great, we're having fun. No, it's,
right.
It's like we're looking at situations that, what is that going to mean next? What's that going to mean this year? Not next year. This year. and we can see it, and we can see it from a long way off. So.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to hearing the entire thing. Yeah. I really appreciate you guys taking the time with me today.
Thank you. Quite an honor.
Appreciate it, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
There you go, Corey Glover and Vernon Reed of Living Color. A massive thank you to Denise of DMK Publicity and Smitty from Zenergy Entertainment Group for helping out with that one. And of course, a massive thank you to Corey and Vernon for taking some time out of their day to sit down and talk to me about all kinds of stuff. Like I said up front, big fan, so this was a big honor to talk to these two guys, have them both on the podcast and have a great discussion, and frankly, one of my favorite ones ever. I'm pretty sure that's a top 10 episode for me. I hope that you enjoyed it as well. If this is your first time listening, there's 392 episodes before this you could check out. It spans the gamut of rock and roll. Icons like Glenn Hughes of Deep Purple and many other things. He's been on here twice. Gene Simmons of Kiss has been on. Frank Cannon of Tesla. Dee Snider of Twisted Sister. Jeff Tate, originally of Queensryche. Members of Guns N' Roses, Whitesnake, Motley Crue, Hellstorm, Shinedown. The list is super long, my friends, and it just keeps growing and coming up. Very shortly, as in next week, Ricky Medlock of Lynyrd Skynyrd and Blackfoot will be here. How cool is that? It's very fucking cool. And then the following weeks, the episodes coming are just as cool. Pete Summitt of Crashing Wayward will be returning. Mike Mostert and Tony Covino of In Theory will be returning. Kevin Codford of Myrith will be here for the first time. Another first-timer, Keith Wallen of Breaking Benjamin. That was a really fun one. All five of those episodes, really looking forward to getting them out to you. Another previous one I wanted to mention is Paige Hamilton from Helmet has been on here a couple times. And one of the times he was on, he talked about, in great detail, the Judgment Night soundtrack, because Helmet, of course, has the song Just Another Victim with House of Pain on there. And he talks about the writing process, everything that went into it. You know, so there you go. If you're a fan of that soundtrack, which if you're listening to this and you're not a fan, I don't know what to tell you. Monumental soundtrack. Check it out if you have not. All right, all the socials. TheThunderUnderground.com. You can listen to the podcast there. You can find all the socials there. So click like, follow, subscribe, whatever it is you do. Wherever you're listening to the podcast right now, click like, follow, subscribe so you don't miss any of those future episodes I mentioned. Wherever you see a post, whether it be on social media or on, like I said, a podcast site, if you can click the like button or share it or comment, that's an easy, free way to support this podcast. A monetary way to support this podcast is to buy merch. So hit up the website, hit me up on any of the socials or email or whatever, and we can get some merch. All right. Once again, a huge thank you to Sunset Tattoo, DEB Concerts, and Vernon Reed and Corey Glover. And until next time.
Sort of, yeah.
Doug, this is Trent.
Hey, man. How you doing?
Pleasure. Thunder Underground, y'all.